Hello, and welcome to the Changemakers podcast. I'm Dave Corlett, Business Director at the creative agency ShapeBuy. And in this series, I chat to leading marketers at what we call Changemaker Brands, businesses on a mission to change the world for the better through technology. What I want to find out is the role that creativity plays in helping them to communicate the benefits of their technology. Hopefully their insights, experience and stories can help you supercharge your own creativity. In this episode of The Changemakers, I'm joined by Matt Harper of Palo Alto Networks. Matt leads a team that focuses on demand generation efforts in the EMEA region for this cybersecurity giant. And I really wanted to pick his brains on what creativity looks like in a modern demand generation machine that can often be viewed as quite technical and functional. We touch on some other really interesting topics too. Why it's more difficult to be creative in a global giant than a plucky startup. How the hackers that Palo Alto Networks protects its customers against are actually a source of creative inspiration for marketers within the business. And how Matt and his team turned the challenges of the pandemic into opportunities to try new things. It is a fascinating discussion. So let's get into it with Palo Alto Networks' Matt Harper. Enjoy. One of the things that struck me when we first started chatting was we went to the same university here in the lovely city of Bristol here in the UK. Obviously, our paths have been slightly different since. So what has taken you from the sunny streets of Bristol via the world of ice cream, I believe, to you've had quite a few roles at Palo Alto as well in the last few years. So you've really risen up the ranks there. So it'd be really good to understand a bit about your journey.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, my first and still to this date best job I ever had was selling ice cream. Which I did both while at university and after university. And it came to a point when I realized, oh, money is that thing that you need to survive and have a happy life, so I need to get a proper job. So I went through a student recruitment firm or a graduate recruitment firm who placed people into mostly tech companies and into mostly business development roles, like sales roles. So I went through that process and I got myself a role in new business development in a relatively small tech company based out of Maidenhead. So I did that for about a few months. Sales really wasn't my thing, but I had a proper job. I felt like I was important, and I was on the phone and doing my hard work. But through a series of strange events where that company was bought out, and I moved back to Bristol, and I didn't really have a role at the company. I found myself just sort of floating around in this mid-sized tech company, not really knowing what to do. Where I got picked up by a stray marketeer in Bristol who needed some help running webinars. And so I said, yeah, I'll give you a hand if you can find a way to help me pay my sales commission or get my sales commission that I'm no longer getting because I'm not doing sales. So we struck up a bit of an agreement that if I get X amount of webinar attendees to these webinars that he needs to run, then he'll pay me my sales commission. And that worked fantastically well for me because it's a lot easier to get webinar attendees than it is to actually make meetings and sales ready leads. So I guess my path into marketing was not conventional. But the more I speak to other marketeers, I find that no one's really had a conventional path into marketing. So I had that role for a while based out of Bristol until the company sort of realized, well, we can't, we have this guy floating around. He's not really in marketing, but he works for marketing and we're paying a sales commission for webinar attendees. Let's get him into the marketing department, which was based out of Amsterdam. So I got in contact with a few folks in Amsterdam, explained to them that, I found this interest in marketing. I've been doing X, Y, Z. I'd like to come and join your team. And at that time, they only had an open headcount in Vietnam. So I said, okay, I'll take it. So I planned my trip to Amsterdam to meet with the HR team and the marketing team who were planning my move out to Vietnam. And the day before I was supposed to go, my car got broken into, my passport was stolen, so I couldn't make the flight. So getting a new passport, I had to drive to, Cardiff or Swansea to get my new passport. Got the flight 2 days later. By the time I'd got there, the person I was supposed to be meeting had left the company. And the new person in charge of marketing said, yeah, we're not going to move you to Vietnam, but we have a role for you here in Amsterdam. So that is eventually what brought me to Amsterdam, working for a company that was called SDL, that I don't think exists under that name anymore. And I did that role for a couple of years, and I basically was doing everything that needed to be done that people hadn't worked out how to do yet. They just installed Marketo, but they had no one who knew how to use it in the EMEA marketing team. So I thought, I'll teach myself how to use it. I'll do some training. If it gets me a trip to the San Francisco Marketo Summit, I'm in. I'll do it. So I did, I was the Marketo lead for the EMEA marketing team for that company for a couple of years. And that's when I was approached by Palo Alto Networks, who needed an email marketing manager to be part of their demand generation hub based in EMEA, as they were, at that time, they were growing very quickly and they were growing their marketing organization very quickly. And that's how I found myself in Palo Alto Networks. And then from being in Palo Alto Networks, I started off as a email marketing manager. And from there, I threw myself every opportunity that came my way. People would come and say, hey, can you help host this live Q&A session or this live webinar? I need help doing this. And I basically just took every opportunity that I got. The amazing thing I found at Palo Alto Networks was my attitude to work before Palo Alto Networks was you need a job to have money to live your life. And your job is the thing that you do between the hours of 9 to 5, and that's it. It's not part of your life. But when I joined Palo Alto Networks, I realized this is a hugely ambitious and motivated company with amazing people and people who are really pushing the boundary and trying to do new things. And that's what encouraged me to put myself forward and to see myself not necessarily as someone ticking a box doing a job because it's a job that I need to have, but to actually find motivation within the work that I was doing and want to push myself forward for the benefit of the company and those around me. So that was a big sort of sea change in my attitude towards work and joining the company. And I think in the years since then, so I've been with Palo Alto for 5 years now, I've had 5 or 6 different roles, all through sort of the necessity of growth. The team's been growing so much, the company's been growing so much, and what would happen is a new challenge or a new function would need to be filled, and there'd be no one that knew how to fill it. And I would always put my hand up and say, hey, I'll take a stab at that. Let me do it. So I went from being a programs manager for cloud marketing, so cloud being the product we use to secure the cloud computing, which was quite new for us, and we needed someone to run the program, so I took that on. Then we had some new leadership come in that needed help doing planning and running the sort of rhythm of the marketing business. So I took that on, which eventually led to me being the chief of staff, the VP of EMEA marketing during 2019, or our fiscal year, so 2019 to 2020. And then right around the start of lockdown, the chief of staff role is only ever going to be a year. It's a sort of interim position always. So I started looking for what do I need to move on to next? And when this would have been early pandemic, so like May, June, we started talking about it. We had this new team set up almost as a response to COVID that needed to be run. So that's now what I do now. So I run our digital demand generation hub, which is a team of 4, so 3 digital marketing specialists aligned to our business and 1 operations team member who is like the oil to the machine that keeps everything going. And I manage that team along with a number of other responsibilities that I have.
Cool. Something I just wanted to pick up on there was the point that you made about Palo Alto being a hugely ambitious and a boundary pushing business. What is it, do you think, about them that kind of sets them apart from maybe other cybersecurity businesses, other competitors in terms of that drive to be constantly innovate?
Yeah, so I think it was that we were given permission to do that by the leadership team at the time, all the way from the founder Nir Zuk to the then CEO Mark McLaughlin and the CEO Mark McLaughlin and the CMO René Bonvanie. So all 3 of them, they really pushed for innovation, creativity, problem solving, and the absolute necessity of being the best cybersecurity company in the world. And if you look at the reason Palo Alto Networks was founded, it's because our founder saw, this way that it was at the time, this isn't working. This is not the best way that we should be securing our networks. This is how we should be doing it. And he believed in it 100%, started his own company, and now, as you mentioned, absolutely Goliath of a cybersecurity company. But I also think we have to give credit to our adversaries, the hackers, the ne'er-do-wells. Like, they are incredibly creative. If you look at what's being done in terms of hacking and cyber threats and cyber attacks, they have to be at the absolute peak of technology themselves if they're going to be successful. I mean, most of cybersecurity is a money game, people trying to extract money by either, holding things to ransom or literally stealing money or threatening to cause problems or steal money. And that's only viable if you're able to make it profitable. So the more money companies are spending on cybersecurity and, you know, securing their environment, the more money it costs in computing power for the criminals to get in and do what they need to do. So they have to be creative all the time. And if you look at the sheer number of attacks that are happening all the time, it's millions a second, and the attackers are just running scripts. They've got AI technology. They've got anything you can imagine. A lot of it, you know, they're state-funded cyber attacks that have unlimited resources, and their creativity is boundless. So for us as a cybersecurity company, we need to match that creativity with our own creativity in problem solving and actually creating cybersecurity products that work and that can adapt to what we're seeing in the market. And that attitude, all the way from, you know, the technology of our company, is filtered all the way down to our marketing departments, to our sales departments, to the whole company, to the point where innovation and disruption are two of our seven core beliefs that we have as a company, and ones that we demonstrate on a day-to-day basis.
That is actually quite fascinating, to be honest. I never thought about cybersecurity as a world where you would be inspired by your enemies and take that inspiration into the fight against them. I mean, just on that note, does it feel more rewarding? You know, I don't mean this in a disrespectful way to some other tech firms out there, but what a lot of them do is, okay, they're involved in positive change and changing business, changing industries, but a lot of that may be to increase shareholder value or to just make, you know, incremental improvements to a company. Ultimately, what you're doing is you're saving people in a much more emotional sense.
Yeah.
You know, you're saving them heartache, you're saving the destruction of their businesses, it's so prevalent at the moment. Like you said, you know, there's hacks every millisecond of every, and a ransomware in particular is just really destroying, you know, businesses and industries. So is there an added sense of purpose there for you?
100%, and that's something that I took straight away from being part of Palo Alto Networks. And admittedly, I am absolutely not a cybersecurity expert. I got caught out by a WhatsApp phishing scam not long ago. I'm not the right person to say, like, yeah, I'm saving the world. But thankfully, I'm part of a company that genuinely is saving people every day. And it's maybe a bit like over the top to say saving lives, but, you know, we secure a lot of hospitals, and security within hospitals is really important. We've seen instances where certain parts of hospital networks have been hacked or ransomware, or technologies have been put offline from it. So it is genuinely very important. And what I particularly like about Palo Alto Networks is we've never been sort of ambulance chasers. So, you know, we don't point fingers, and we don't call out companies that have failed to secure their customers in whatever reason. And we don't go running after ambulances when we hear about a hack on the news. You know, we're not going, hey, let us, you know, you should buy us instead of the current technology you've got. Instead, we're actually there to offer a helping hand behind the scenes. You know, we don't need the publicity for it. We'll reach out and say, you know, we saw this happen. Please, you know, if you'd like, we can help you out with that. And here is what we recommend. But it's a really, you know, I love being a part of a company that takes that attitude towards things. And it does give me a real sense of pride that I know my company is making the world a better and safer place. And it's safer for kids, you know, it's safer for schools, it's safer for hospitals and for people, and giving people that peace of mind, even though most people wouldn't have heard of us. You know, unless you're in tech or in cybersecurity, you won't have heard of Palo Alto Networks. You can almost guarantee that, you know, a large portion of the world has felt the benefit of Palo Alto Network technology in some way. And that does give me an immense sense of pride.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the beauty of the kind of the world of, I guess, what you call B2B tech. You know, a lot of it happens behind the scenes. You might not necessarily be familiar that the businesses, although they're, you know, like we said, multi-billion dollar businesses, they're not necessarily household names, but you will have experienced the benefit of a lot of them, either in your working life or even in your personal life as well. Cool. So just moving on to your role then, it'd be good just to get an insight into kind of what a typical week looks like for you, really, you know, in terms of campaigns worked on, responsibilities and goals and things like that.
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, I manage the team that is the digital demand generation hub. And we have three members that are specifically running the digital campaigns for our three main business units, or GTM, go-to-markets as we call them. So I manage that team along with the operations guy who is responsible for, you know, he basically holds the keys to all of our technology that we use to run virtual events, webinars, landing pages, things like that. And he executes all of the activities that are happening throughout the email marketing team where they need support on building those assets and the virtual real estate. But from my point of view, from the sort of the manager's point of view, I guess the thing that I'm always looking at is our sales funnel, our demand generation funnel. So Monday morning starts with a team call between my team and sort of the broader team of demand gen and programs managers and campaign managers, and we look at how are we tracking on our demand generation funnel and our main KPIs towards towards linearity for the quarter. You know, do we see any red flags? Where are we seeing problems? What campaigns are working well? Where are we seeing high conversion rates? We also do things like manage the email schedule just to make sure we're not conflicting with each other's emails and that we've got a healthy amount of communication coming out from our sort of central team. I'm really looking at, I think if you boil it down, it's are we on track to hit our numbers? Like that weekly taking the pulse of, are we having enough demand to reach our pipeline numbers? Does our sales figures look good? And like taking that all the way back down to the lead funnel, down to, you know, how are we driving the amount of MELs that we need to marketing engaged leads? Where are the conversion rates slipping? Where are we seeing high conversion rates? And that's something we do. So I'm actually part of two meetings a week that look specifically at that. So I have one with my team on a Monday, and then on the Tuesday it's with the leadership team. So we really go a bit deeper into the detail and look at it on a more regional level. So we are always up to date and aware of, you know, how are we doing towards our targets? What actions are we taking to remediate any situations, or to, you know, if there are any blockers, what can we do to alleviate it? And then the next sort of big part of my role is I'm actually responsible for planning and budgeting. So we have quarterly planning cycle at the moment, which doesn't happen once a quarter. It almost happens all the way through every quarter. So, you know, we're in our Q4 now. It started 2 weeks ago. And in a couple of weeks, we start planning for FY22 Q1. So it's like an ongoing, constant cycle of planning. So that's something that I'm always looking at. You know, are we on budget? Are we spending the money? How do we need to build the budget for next quarter to meet certain demands and certain needs that we see? What are the business challenges that can be happening in FY22 that mean we have to plan for that now in terms of how we build our budget? And that's a constant cycle of just making sure, you know, we are on top of what we need to be, so that our teams in the field who are responsible for really building the plan, they can build a plan that meets the need of their region. And then the sort of final thing that I'm responsible for, which is a new responsibility, is customer advocacy. I mean, I think anyone will tell you having great customer case studies and customer stories is a huge tool for marketing. And we're now making a much bigger investment, both in terms of time and resources and money, to deliver, you know, more and better customer case studies that we can go and tell the success stories that we have. I think we have a challenge in that being a cybersecurity company, people don't always want to talk about their cybersecurity infrastructure, just because, you know, it's a bit maybe taboo. You know, you don't want to be going and spreading your wares to anyone. But yeah, it's a little bit of an extra challenge. But I think there are still some amazing stories out there, and we hope to tell them.
I'm just wondering, from the point of view of demand generation, do you think that if we can call it a discipline, do you think that it's a discipline that lends itself to the opportunity to be creative? And if so, you know, where are the opportunities to push the boundaries a little bit of creativity to help you guys maybe do things that are slightly different to competitors? There's so much noise around these days that it's really important to not fade into that noise. You know, what does demand generation, you know, how does it lend itself to creativity?
Firstly, yes, I think there is a lot of room for creativity in demand generation roles, and particularly in my team. It's something that I try to encourage, that we take steps to make time to be creative. You need to have that space where you're not expected to have an output of the, you know, 20% of your time. You're not expected to be doing emails or meetings or creating something. You can just literally take the time to think and problem solve and try and be creative. And I think actually the attitude towards creativity really depends on the maturity of the company. And particularly with tech companies, So if I take sort of Palo Alto Networks as a specific example, in the earlier days, so maybe just as I was joining a bit earlier, there was a clear mandate to just do what had to be done to get share of voice, do what had to be done to get in front of customers, make noise, be audacious, take risks, you know, spend the money if you need to, because we have to fight for every inch of brand awareness that we got. We hear great, you know, amazing tales of, you know, we didn't have enough money to sponsor this big event, so we, you know, hired a bus and put our logo on the side and parked it out front of the exhibition hall. Or, you know, we sold French fries outside the front of the exhibition hall and had our brand all over it. And, you know, that kind of, you know, and the freedom that was given to the teams then to just go and get it done. And I think when you're in a startup phase of a company, you do get given a lot more permission to be audacious and take those risks. And, you know, there's particularly in sort of the Silicon Valley tech companies, you hear all these different stories of how companies are just trying to grab your attention, trying to get their name out there. And because, you know, that without doing that, there's no way we would be on the, you know, the list of RFPs or getting into the customer's, frame of mind. So, yeah, you hear things that, you know, where we would send the, I don't know if we necessarily Palo Alto Networks, but I heard stories where we would send the charger cable to a device and say, hey, if you want the device, you have to attend this meeting, come and join. Or, you know, really being a bit cheeky and trying to, you know, using swear words in slogans and things like that. But all of that's happening all the time. If you go to a trade show or an exhibition in the States, all of the tech companies, they're all pushing so hard. Actually, one in London that I went to, I think you're aware of it, the B2B conference, the B2B marketing conference. There, a company, I think it was Turtle in the end, They hosted a fake protesting PDFs, because I think they're a company that make like interactive digital assets. And that's sort of the attitude that you see a lot of startup younger companies where, yeah, take a risk, go and be a little bit silly, make people remember your name. So I think definitely there's loads of opportunity for creativity there. And it's fundamental that you are creative, because if you just, you know, if you're a startup and all you do is do webinars, white paper downloads, and attend exhibition booths, no one's going to have heard of you, you know, unless your technology is absolutely incredible. Now we're a lot more mature. We're still, you know, sometimes it still feels like a startup, but we are a much bigger, much more mature company, and the creativity needs to be a bit more measured. So, like I said, we do encourage teams to be creative, and two of our sort of core beliefs as a company are innovation and disruption. They're always important. If you look at the technology, we're always improving and innovating and disrupting markets, you know, across the board in terms of our technology. And in marketing, we try to do the same, but we need to be measured. You know, there's more at stake now, so we need to keep that that steady drumbeat and rhythm of reliable and proven marketing tactics to make sure that we maintain a consistent voice and a consistent message and a consistent volume of leads in the funnel, and that we're able to support ourselves to create and close pipeline that they're doing it. And I think that there you do potentially find the risk of getting into a little bit of a rut, and then creativity takes the back seat. And I think that's quite tough. I mean, we have struggled with it, and I mean me specifically, personally, and some of my team members. Just because, yeah, it's all well and good saying dedicate like Friday afternoons to trying to be creative or introduce creative ideas. But when you're part of a bigger team with more functions, it's much harder to push ideas through, because it'll have to go through this team if you're going to use the website, this team if you need this technology, this team if you need to use that agency. Whereas when you're a bit smaller, you can take an idea from inception all the way to completion. And I don't think that's a possibility with large teams. So yeah, the answer is yes, it's important. Yes, we do try really hard to be creative as much as we can, but with sort of within guardrails and in a measured way. And sometimes, you know, we don't always get to make time for it, which is a shame. But I think it's the reality of any big company.
Yeah, for sure. I think just going back to Turtle, I think they're quite renowned for doing slightly more creative stunts at B2B conferences. It's not the first one I've heard of. So yeah, I think also, you know, one thing that creativity thrives on quite often is restriction. So when you're talking about startups, you know, lack of budget, and it is quite a key one, really. If you're restricted by the lack of budget, then obviously you've got to think a lot harder and be a lot more creative in your in your approach. And I guess, so just moving on from that slightly, you know, when we talk about innovation and disruption, you know, they are really key values, you know, for I would say, you know, any tech firm worth its salt, really. But just in terms of more specifically cybersecurity, are the kind of the topics of conversation and the pain points of your prospects and customers, if you're aligning them with those values of innovation and disruption, is it a sector that lends itself to being creative in terms of the way that you frame those pain points and the solutions that you bring to them?
Yeah, so I mean, you'd think that cybersecurity is very straight-laced, very serious, you know, like this is very important. And you'd almost make the assumption, and you'd be forgiven for making the assumption, that people who are cybersecurity managers in big companies are very serious and very straight-laced. But at the end of the day, they're people that, and a lot of the time, they really enjoy their work. Their work is a lot of problem-solving. It's a lot of creativity in terms of how they implement technology and, you know, how they run their IT departments or their cybersecurity departments, you know, depending on the size of the company. And actually they're just people, you know, they're coders, and they're people that quite enjoy the sport of like hacking, and they quite enjoy the one-upmanship of, hey, look at the way that I've been able to implement this technology, or look at the way that I've been able to do that. So yeah, you'd think maybe there isn't much room for creativity, but there is a lot, and we get There's a pull for creativity to come from the cybersecurity industry and sort of the tech industry in general. So I think you wouldn't necessarily think so, but there definitely is, and there is. You know, we see some of the ways that our technology is being implemented that we wouldn't have thought of. Like, wow, that's a really genius way of using the infrastructure of our technology to solve this problem. And it's that problem solving element of it where I think people get the creative buzz. I mean, if I just think of my own personal roles and my attitude towards creativity, in my early career and when I was at university, creativity to me meant almost like creating art, and whether art was like visual or audio or like graphic, that was what creativity was. And when I got into professional employment, I would always demand having a Photoshop license so that I can still flex my creative muscle. And you know, when I was in email marketing roles, I'd make my own banners rather than go to an agency. I'd always make my own like birthday cards for friends, and that to me at the time is what creativity meant. But now creativity to me in my personal role is problem solving. How can I creatively solve this problem in something that doesn't have to be visually beautiful or anything like that? So a lot of my role right now, I use things like our G Suite, like you know, Google Sheets and things like that, and I problem solve using, you know, spreadsheets, which I get a buzz off that I never thought I would. 5 years ago, I used to think that creativity is if I can have an artistic flair that people are gonna love to look at. But now, if I can find a really ingenious way of solving a problem with a spreadsheet, that gives me that same sense of flow, and like I'm creating something, or I'm doing something novel, that you can also get from creativity. And I think that is the same in cybersecurity. So even though it is very serious and important that it gets done right, there's a lot of freedom for creativity there, and that's what we're hearing from our customers as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo everything that you've said, really. You know, as a creative agency, you know, we're primarily a team of designers, motion graphics experts and whatnot, but it's certainly not just word. It's certainly not the pretty picture side of things. You know, it is looking at the world in a different way, you know, and expressing yourself in a different way that makes people sit up and take notice, for sure, and to ultimately achieve your goals. So we've just commissioned quite a large survey of B2B tech marketers, 100 in the UK, 100 in the US, to get their input on their attitudes towards creativity, and in particular, how the events of the past year have led to them either being less or more brave, taking more risks, you know, what the lay of the land's been as far as that's concerned. And what came out of it was that actually, for the most part, a lot of them have been able to be, or they've been forced to be, braver and take more risks and be more creative with what they're doing because of the challenges that COVID's thrown up. And is that something that chimes with you in your experience?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when I think back to when we first went into like lockdown, like events were getting cancelled and, you know, things were coming off the plan left, right, and center. We as an entire well, I'll just talk about the marketing team. The whole organization, we went through change, obviously, but as a marketing team, we really needed to change the way we were doing things. So everything had to be digitized. Everything had to be virtual event or, you know, virtual engagement style of activity. And at first, I think it was quite novel. You know, it was scary because we were all in a global pandemic, but it was like, hey, look, we're all having meetings online instead of face-to-face. And hey, we hosted this this event that we were going to do in Paris in a nice restaurant on next week. We managed to do it online and it was great and everyone had a nice time. So at the beginning, there was that forced creativity out of necessity. We had to do something. We had to find a solution. And I think that solution was just get everything online and make it work. And then once it became clear that this is not a short-term thing that's going to be over in a couple of weeks or months, this is something that's going to go on a lot longer, we needed to actually find those structural ways of being creative and structural ways of solving the problem. And we found a lot of help through sort of lots of boutique agencies that we've been working with. So everyone in our regional marketing teams and people in my team have been finding, you know, new and fun ways. And I think we've all seen pictures on LinkedIn of like wine tasting, gin tasting, beer tasting, cocktail, everything I've just named is alcohol there, like tea drinking, pizza dough making, all that kind of stuff. And I think it's something that I think would have worked pre-COVID if people had been brave enough to actually do it. And it, you know, we don't always have to go and sit in a stuffy hotel room or a stuffy meeting room for the whole day. I think these activities have proven that, you know, you can have enjoyment of that that experience of that, you know, through a virtual world and gain the same benefit. But in terms of how did that relate to our creativity and how that reflect our creativity, again, it came down to like problem solving. How do we maintain the volume and the quality of work that we're doing while we're restricted by, you know, not being able to move, not being able to have in-person meetings? And I think we, in a number of cases, we really shone. And like some of the ways that we handled not being able to do like our big, our key events or our key activities that are like the mainstay of our marketing plan, we found ways to get it done. And I think in the time, maybe it didn't feel like creativity because it was, you know, we had to get it done. We had to solve this problem. But when you look back, there was a lot of individual moments of problem solving that would have only worked because people were able to think creatively. And I think without the, now, you know, we've been in the, as a company, we've had restricted movement, like regardless of what's happening in your country or your region or your theater, we've not been permitted to go to any office, do any work travel whatsoever. And I think that's actually helped us to focus on what needs to be done and actually create a little bit more time to be a bit more creative. I think when you're, you know, flying from event to event, or if you're worrying about getting goodies shipped here, or you know, you're stuck in this meeting room or whatever, that takes up a lot of your working week. And now people actually have time to, you know, finish a meeting, go sit on their sofa, take a little bit of the weight off. And I know personally I do my best creative thinking when I'm not thinking about it, and having that space and that room to just let my mind wander, let my subconscious do some thinking. You know, walking the dog right before I'm about to fall asleep or watching TV is when I have the best ideas, or I go, that's how I'm going to solve that problem. And I think that's probably the case for a lot of people. And I think having that extra time to be at home in a comfortable space will allow people the chance to let creative ideas thrive, rather than always feeling the constant push and, you know, push to move forward.
So it sounds like there's quite a lot of things that you've toyed with or, you know, reworked over the last year or so that you're going to take into.
I 100% expect so. Yeah, I mean, things like joining a meeting and we send you a voucher to order your own pizza and you have a pizza on us. That sort of stuff we were never doing before. We'd force people to sit in a room with us. You know, we'd force people to travel. And then, you know, we'd have to put on a whole show and dance. And I think this is something we'll definitely carry on forward. And I'd like to see where it goes next. I think one area where creativity's kind of failed during lockdown is that we've tried to, and I don't mean we in Palo Alto Networks, even though in some aspects I do. I mean, as an industry, we've tried to replace the things that we didn't really like before, like for like. So for example, trade shows. I don't know if you've been to a virtual trade show with virtual booths. It doesn't work. Like, I mean, come on. No, it's just not working. And I don't know why I've seen so many instances where We have a 3-day virtual trade show, which is the same 3 days it would have been if it was live. And you have virtual booths and you have virtual this and that. And I think, yeah, this isn't working. There have been some companies that I've seen do really cool versions. I can't remember, it might have been Adobe that did it, where it's like, okay, we normally have this 3-day event. Now it's a month long, it's split up. So it only makes sense to have a day's worth of agenda if you've got everyone on location. Otherwise, what's the point making someone sit behind their laptop for 6 hours straight, absorbing all the content that you're gonna show them anyway? Spread it out a bit, make it a bit more fun, more interactive, give people a bit more space. And I think that's where there's still a lot more room for creativity. And I think maybe, you know, continuing or after COVID is cleared up, hopefully, whenever that is, we will start to see some of these tactics implemented and some change to the way that marketing is expected to act and expected to deliver.
So last question from me, and it's something that I think going forward I want to ask all of our guests on this, which is, if you got a particular campaign or project from your time at Palo Alto that you're particularly proud of, like a number one that stands out?
Yeah, I've got a couple, one recent and one from my early days. I'm going to do both of them, if it's okay.
Go for it.
All right, so I'll do the first one was when I was email marketing manager, and we had a couple of guys from the marketing data science team that I was friends with in the office, and we had a new intern who was working with the marketing data science team. And we were just mates who worked in the office. We didn't have much interaction with each other, but I think it might have been having lunch or playing table tennis. We thought this idea of trying to predict the like or the most, what was it? We basically what the MDS guy, marketing data science team, wanted to create a model that would predict the most likely asset that someone was going to download if it was emailed to them. So looking at all the historical data and breaking the demographic up and saying, like, this group of people are most likely to react to an ebook, this group of people to a dummies guide, this or that. And it was summertime, not much happens in Europe in the summer, and we had this huge email database that was relatively low engagement that we just needed to do something with. So we created this project called Operation Cupid, where we were going to run this marketing data science algorithm to try and predict the assets most likely to be downloaded by individual groups of people in our database. And throughout the summer, we'd sort of test the thesis, email them in these batches. And it was something we just did on our own. No one told us to do it. We didn't talk about it too much while we were doing it. We just sort of kept the team up to date. And we got to the end of it and we're like, wow, that was quite successful. That was cool. And then we kind of like put it in a drawer. So the intern who was working with us, he wrote his thesis about it in university. And we sort of put it in a drawer and said, that worked really well. You know, we did a bit of a presentation and it ended there. And then a couple months later, we were all in California for marketing all hands. And the marketing data science guy runs up to me and he says, hey, Matt, we're launching this new attribution model for marketing. And we were running through the data sets and the dashboards. And when they run it on historic data, Operation Cupid was by far the greatest attribution for any marketing tactic of the last like 2 years. So we're like, what? We need to tell more people about this. So that's number one. And I think that one, it's a nice example of creativity coming from like a data science guy who isn't thinking of creativity in terms of, you know visual perfection or art or color. He's thinking about fun ways to interrogate data and what he can do with AI and algorithms.
Can I just ask a question on that? So it's an interesting point. Do you get the freedom then to kind of do those kind of projects where it's kind of don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness later, that further down the line, so the freedom to be able to just run with something and see where it goes?
I'd say that we did have it back when we did that, but not so much now, and mostly because of the way that the company is now structured in its lines of business. So back then, there was not as much ownership of individual parts of the business. So I could just sort of tell, and at that time we just told the then like director of EMEA marketing, hey, we're doing this. And she was like, okay, cool. And now there'd be lots of gates of permission we'd have to go through. And, you know, we probably didn't write the emails as well as we should have done. We probably didn't use the right branding that we should have done. All of that stuff is sort of a big slap on the wrist now. And at that time, we were able to get away with it. We probably would have got a slap on the wrist if someone interrogated it when we did it. No one complained.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you know, there is a logic to that. You can't really have people running around, you know, pretty much unchecked, or to a degree anyway, left, right and centre, especially as you grow and get bigger.
Yeah.
But I guess it's a balance, right, isn't it? You know, you need to kind of give people the freedom.
Yeah, of course, we did our best, and we didn't see it as taking much of a risk. You know, we worked within our email guidelines about database engagement and things like that. So we weren't taking any risk there. It was more a case of... And at that time, I was also the owner of the email schedule for EMEA. So I knew what was coming, I knew what was happening, and I could always prioritize other events and activities so that we weren't going to damage anything else that was happening. It was more a case of, we've got this, like, I think it was 100K, like, people who never end up being pulled into email marketing lists. They never end up, if they do, they never end up responding. Like, let's not let them die on the vine. Let's try and do something to reinvigorate them. And that was the main thought process. And yeah, but you're right. It isn't safe to have people running around doing what they want, and there was an element of that back then, but we certainly wouldn't be able to get away with it now. We wouldn't even try now. So for example, now we have a team that's dedicated at looking at that type of stuff and making sure it doesn't happen. You know, they're running nurtures and they're doing all this, you know, intelligent data things. So that's happening at a structural level now, the same sort of thing, whereas before we just did it out of curiosity.
Cool. So on to number two.
So yeah, number two is a much more recent one. And I'm particularly proud of it because I actually won an award for it for my collaboration. And that's around a program we did for the cybersecurity predictions for 2021. So obviously it happened right at the new year. Every year we have our sort of leading cybersecurity experts in the company who are sort of our chief security officers. And chief information security officers, they make their predictions for what we're going to see in 2021, and it's usually a bit of PR, maybe an article or a blog. But this time around, we wanted to. So in the past, so we had done a couple of webinars around it, like a one-off or a small webinar. This time around, we wanted to really push the boat out and do as much as we could and make a lot of noise around it. Because yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening within cybersecurity, particularly around COVID, like. The types of threats we're seeing are just completely different or like applied in a different way. So there's lots of interesting stuff happening. So we ran a webinar series. I think it was 9 live webinars in the end. And we had, I'm embarrassed, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think it was around 4,000 or 5,000 total registrations. And we had loads of engagement throughout the webinars. You know, we had a survey that ran sort of concurrent with the webinar so people could answer questions as they go. We had experts online to do the Q&A session, and we just had a really highly engaged audience, great content. And the reason I'm proud of it is because it was quite a big project that I was sort of the, you know, I always feel a bit guilty because I didn't do much of the actual work. I was sort of managing the people who were doing the work who did, you know, a fantastic job. But the program itself was a huge success, and we sort of capped it all off with a LinkedIn Live event. So, you know, those sort of live broadcasts on LinkedIn Live, which at the time was the most successful in terms of engagement and viewers that Palo Alto Networks had done in its history. So yeah, huge, wow. Huge win for us as an EMEA team. And we're still seeing all the benefits from that level of engagement in terms of our pipeline numbers now.
Nice. What award did it win?
So I personally won the Collaborator Award. So every quarter we have a marketing awards that are aligned to our 7 values in business. So I mentioned before that we have innovation, disruption. I won for collaboration. There's also one for integrity, one for inclusion, and one inclusion diversity, and one for execution. I can't believe I remember more.
No, that's cool. Brilliant. Well, congratulations on that. That's awesome. And yeah, here's to many more award wins in future. Listen, Matt, I think we'll leave it there, but I just want to say thanks so much. That was a really, really interesting chat. Cybersecurity is, I mean, I got an email, I think it was start of this week, and it looked like a ransomware email, but it also looked like somebody who was maybe just fishing around and saying, look, you know, I've got something on you. Why don't you pay me a few Bitcoin or whatever? So I kind of, I did delete it, but I it's been playing on my mind for a little while now, whether there's going to be any repercussions from that. I mean, I do doubt it, but then that's me probably being a bit lax.
Yeah.
But I mean, so these days, it honestly does affect all of us, doesn't it? You know, and I think It's really interesting to talk about creativity in that sector as well, because I was fascinated by what you said about actually feeding off, in some ways, you know, the real enemies in all of this piece, you know, which is the people who are trying to take our hard-earned money and basically just profit from being horrible. So it's actually a fascinating point on that. But so there's lots I'll take away from this. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for being part of the Changemaker series.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.